From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, we'll talk with the Boston researcher who helped document the damage the Zika virus can cause to babies' developing brains. Also today, author Joseph Finder about why he decided to write about spying rather than become a spy himself, and why Massachusetts is so prominent in his books.
I like writing about Massachusetts because it's almost a character in my mind. I sort of know the city. I sort of like the idea that my characters are rooted in a real place.
And looking for the perfect tomato.
A tomato is just like a baby. You got to treat it with gentle care and love.
Plus, the band behind David Bowie's final album, Black Star. All this coming up on Radio Boston. First, this news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Boston researchers have released the most complete picture so far of how the Zika virus can damage the brain of a fetus. Their study, published in the journal Radiology, shows detailed graphic images of how the virus can affect the developing brains of babies. The report suggests that microcephaly, a condition that results in babies born with brain damage and unusually small heads, could be just one of the things that Zika can do to a developing brain. Joining us from Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center is Dr. Deborah Levine. She's a professor of radiology at Harvard Medical School and a co-author of this study. Dr. Levine, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
So we have a number of images from your study at our website at radioboston.org. Tell us essentially what you think the main finding is here from you and your co-authors after examining images from more than 40 Brazilian babies and fetuses.
Well, first, I need to give a huge amount of credit to the entire author group from Brazil because they're the ones who had the foresight when the Zika infection was first being recognized to start following these women who had a rash in pregnancy or whose babies were born with microcephaly. And they did an amazing job with the imaging. So in this study, what we're looking at are the images that they acquired. But of the patients that were initially referred, we're only looking at the imaging of about 10%. And those are the ones that had the confirmed Zika infection or had the classic appearance of a bad Zika infection. And it's not just the microcephaly, like you said. Some of them, the brain actually isn't small. It's a normal size, but the brain's basically filled with water, so it's not yet shrunk down yet. And then we saw many, many other abnormalities in the brains as well.
So I wonder, does that mean that then when a baby is born, the effects of the Zika virus might not be apparent, maybe for some time?
Well, that's definitely a concern. So we're looking at a very severe infection, and it turns out that most of the women who had the babies in our study had a rash in the first trimester. And so that seems to be the time when you get this classic Zika appearance of the microcephaly where the forehead is sloping backwards, and we have these very, very severe abnormalities inside the brain. But we don't know what happens with the more mild infections, and we don't know what happens with the later infections, and there's a lot of work going on now to figure that out.
So what do we know about what the Zika virus is doing to the developing brain?
Well, we know that it is very potentially damaging to the developing brain if the fetus becomes infected. So it's interfering with the way that the brain cells normally form. And so it causes a lot of problems in the normal structures of the brain and the folding of the brain. It also causes an inflammation so that the ventricles, the fluid part of the central part of the brain, get obstructed and they don't drain normally. And that's why you get the large fluid-containing areas of the brain. And then it also destroys what might have been some normally formed brain. And we see calcifications as evidence of this. And calcifications in a lot of different areas of the brain, some of which are very unusual locations for calcification as well.
And so why is that important, finding calcification? Explain that to those of us who may not know.
Well, it's not a good thing to have an infection in utero. And when we see an infection, usually the calcifications that we see are going to be on the outside of the brain, or they're going to be lining the ventricles, that fluid part of the brain. And we're seeing the calcifications in other areas, the gray-white junction, which is a little bit inside where we would normally see it, and also in the deep structures of the brain. And these are not completely unheard of in other infections, but the fact that they're in just about every single one of these fetuses and neonates, it just goes along with the severity of the infection and the fact that it is involving these nerve cells in the way that they migrate as well.
You know, your study apparently confirms that the Zika virus does the most harm in the first trimester of pregnancy. Does this at all help you advise women on what to do if they get the rash or any kind of symptoms, or what they should be watching out for?
Well, what we're mostly doing with this study is educating the medical community on what they can expect to see when there's this severe infection. There have been a lot of prior reports that have had a few images, but what we've done here is make available a lot of images, 76 images of fetuses, neonates, babies. We have ultrasound, CT, and MR. Before birth, the ultrasound and MR, magnetic resonance imaging, afterbirth CTs and pictures of the babies. So we're making these images freely available to healthcare providers throughout the world. But we haven't answered the question of what to tell patients, because that's kind of beyond the scope of this study. But the Center for Disease Control, the CDC, has some wonderful information that they're always updating, and that's definitely where I would tell patients to go. First, to see their healthcare provider if they're concerned, and secondly, if they want to go online, to go to the Center for Disease Control website.
What struck you the most?
How very, very severe these infections were, and the fact that we took all these different pregnant women and babies who came in for many different presentations, and yet when you looked at the brains, they all had very, very similar findings. And the severity of the infection was exceptionally striking.
What do you think is next in terms of studying babies' brains and Zika?
Well, the questions we alluded to previously, what about if we don't see this? If we see this severe infection, we know, unfortunately, the prognosis is grim. But what about the babies who had the more mild infections? Or what about the ones who maybe got the infection in the third trimester? Or what if there's a baby that's born and gets a mosquito bite himself or herself? We don't know what that means, and there's a lot more research still to be done.
All right, Dr. Deborah Levine, Director of Obstetric and Gynecologic Ultrasound at Beth Israel and a professor of radiology at Harvard Medical School. She's the co-author of a new study in the journal Radiology on the Zika virus and its effects on babies' brains. Some of the images from that study are at our website, radioboston.org. Dr. Levine, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for talking to me.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. Coming up, Boston author Joseph Finder. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Well, if you recognize the name Nick Heller, then you've probably already read the latest thriller by Joseph Finder. His new book, Guilty Minds, is the third novel where Nick Heller is the lead character and is investigating a complicated conspiracy. Conspiracies are not only the hallmarks of Finder's books, but they fit right in with his background as a Russian scholar and one-time planned to become a spy. Joseph Finder joins us to talk about his latest work and his writing process. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, great to be here.
So tell us, how did a Russian scholar and potential spy, an actual CIA recruit, decide to write suspense novels?
Yeah, I was a Russian studies major in college, and I was fluent in Russian. And I was very interested in Soviet politics and Soviet intelligence. And it's sort of a natural that I would have been recruited to the CIA because I sort of fit the profile of what they were looking for at that point. Mm. When I was shown the cubicle where I'd be sitting, translating Soviet economic journals from Russian to English, I remember thinking, this is not what I want to do. I really would like to do something more interesting, more exciting. And I decided at that point to try something I'd always wanted to do, which is to write fiction, to write thrillers, to write spy novels. And so it was a risky move on my part because I had a clear path chosen. But it turns out to be something that I really love.
Hmm. And so what did you do? You just started writing?
I gave myself 3 years to sell a book. I didn't want to be a poor, starving artist for years. So I started writing and writing and writing and rewriting. And I sent it to an agent, and it was rejected, and I went back and forth and back and forth. And during the process of rejection, I actually learned how to write a good thriller. I also read a bunch of the great thrillers, the great spy novels and crime novels, and took notes and sort of studied them. It was my own kind of personal graduate school in how to write a thriller. Mm. And then at the end of 3 years, within 3 years, I was able to sell the book to Viking in the U.S. and Pan in the U.K., and I was able to, and it, for enough money to support myself. So I just started writing the next one.
Who would you say are some of the writers who really shaped your writing?
It's a weird range, because when I was a kid, I loved the Ian Fleming James Bond novels. I think they were way above my head, frankly. I think there are references in there I did not understand at that point. I read a little later on, I read Ken Follett's The Eye of the Needle, mm-hmm. and Robert Ludlum's Bourne novel, and I began to sort of become interested in trying to do something like that. But there was a whole range of influences, from John le Carré to Eric Ambler to Graham Greene to the modern thriller novelist Nelson DeMille, for example. Mm-hmm. So it's a wide range. Mm-hmm.
Well, let's talk about having a protagonist in almost a series, if you will. Three of your books, as we said in the beginning, involve Nick Heller as the protagonist. He's a tough, sort of smart investigator, a private spy. He's got a strong sense of humor and sense of justice, but he's also somebody completely willing to break the rules, maybe
right.
someone's nose even, to try to get done what he thinks needs to be done. Who's Nick Heller modeled after, and why go in this direction with your writing to have one protagonist in a series of books?
Well, it is interesting that when you publish a book, and you've published several, you often get readers coming up to you saying, are we going to have that character again? Will you do Adam again, or Jason, or whatever? And the thing is, when you're writing a standalone novel, you can't you can't sort of take that one character whose life is upended and put him into another novel and have the same thing happen the next day or the next book. So I realized that there is this hunger that people have for the continuing characters. It's what makes us watch television shows and become sort of addicted to television shows or novels. But I wanted to write something that hadn't been done before. And I felt that the Private Eye novel had been done a million times, and quite well. I wanted to do something different, so I discovered, talking to a friend of mine who was in the CIA, that a lot of CIA officers went private after the fall of the Berlin Wall. Hmm. And they were basically doing for governments and for politicians and for private individuals the same kind of work they did before. So I had it. At that point, I realized private spy would be my character, something I hadn't done before. And I was able to sort of take this character, Nick Heller, and have him be an investigator who in each story investigates a different conspiracy. But he is a tough guy, but he's also very cerebral. He really thinks these things through. And he's got a sense of humor, and he turns out to be a great joy to write. And I get all kinds of emails from people who really love the character, Nick Heller. So I'm feeling that it's catching on, that it's starting to work.
I'm almost wondering.
Novel number three.
Oh, sorry. I'm almost wondering, is there a little bit of you in there and what you would have been like had the CIA been more interesting to you?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a wish fulfillment Joe Fender's words. All right, it's not the real me. I can't do any of the stuff that Nick Heller does. So believe me, it's wish fulfillment.
So in the book, you know, you write about, as we said, complicated conspiracies. In this one, in Guilty Minds, there's a story about journalism, and Nick Heller is hired to discredit a gossip website story that's
right.
about to appear that really goes after a U.S. Supreme Court justice. And you talk about the editorial process. You talk about internet news and privacy. Mm-hmm. And your other books have had a little bit about journalism in them as well, one involving a journalist who lost his job. Why is this an area of interest for you, do you think?
Oh, that's a good question. One answer would be that when I was starting out learning how to write fiction, I also wrote a lot of nonfiction on the side. I did short pieces for the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and places like that. And I became interested in the life of a journalist. I became interested in the sort of what was going on with journalism, just as an observer. And it seems to me now that with the rise of the internet, we're seeing a complete revolution in journalism. And I find it to be an interesting subject matter. I find it to be something that I am drawn to, even though I don't intend to do it. In the case of Guilty Minds, I was interested in the rise of websites like Gawker or TMZ, gossip websites that are able to put things up that aren't necessarily sourced accurately, that are not necessarily true, and get away with it. And that and the internet sort of amplifies this gossip so that it goes all over the world. It's incredibly powerful. And I thought, you know, this was, of course, I was writing this a couple of years ago before Gawker went out of business, which they're doing apparently this week. I sort of realized that this was a great way to show the different kind of journalism that exists in the age of the internet, whether it's gossip or whether it's legitimate journalism, sort of doing battle with gossip websites.
Right. Now, obviously, you did a lot of research, not just about journalism and investigative journalism and online things, but there's a lot about technology in the book, the use of technology to help sort of figure things out and investigate the use of technology too in journalism as well. So you obviously had to really look into that. At one point, I read that you interviewed various people about this, folks from internet security places, a Boston Globe investigative journalist. I'm wondering how you balance the research and the writing part of this, especially when I'm told that your goal is to write one book a year. That's a tall order.
That's also a great question because when you write a book a year, you do not have time to fool around. Hmm. And I love doing research. It's probably my favorite part of the process. I love talking to people about what they do and finding out how things really work. So I find myself sort of having to restrain myself from doing any more research. I do. I figure things out. I learn things. I make phone calls. I email people. I learn some really cool things, which I'm able to pass on to my readers. But, you know, the main thing is to write the story. So I limit my research to maybe 2 or 3 months. And then I spend the rest of the year working on writing the story and editing it, revising it. But the research is great. I mean, I love actually using fiction as a way to educate people. I know that sounds maybe a little pretentious because it's not an educational experience necessarily. It's an entertainment experience. But I like the idea of using fiction to disseminate information. And one of the things I learned really early on in my novel writing career, is that people will talk to me who would never talk to a journalist from the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or the Washington Post or whatever.
That's interesting.
They will talk and they'll speak openly. So people who work in classified material will talk to me because I'm writing fiction and they know their name's never going to appear in it. So I was able to actually find things out that I would not have been able to find out if I were a journalist.
Hmm. Now, the pacing in your book, it really keeps the reader, at least this one, me, reading quickly, right? I want to find out what happens next. I'm going, and suddenly I'm 100 pages in, right? Was that a technique that you had to learn, or how would you describe that process and why you pull a reader in like that?
Well, it's my theory that our attention span as a culture has gotten shorter and shorter. If you look at suspense movies from the 1940s or 50s, they're paced in a much slower way. Books were actually longer and tended to have a more deliberate pace to them as well. But I think that first movies and then television shows and then the internet, they've all kind of torqued our sense of pacing and our attention span, so that I basically feel I need to have short scenes that sort of come at you quickly and that turn the plot with each scene. In other words, there's a hook at the end of each scene. So, and it takes a fair amount of effort behind the scenes, but it's not what I want my readers to know. I want them to just sort of read and coast through it and glide through it as quickly as possible. But in order to make that work, you have to do a lot of work behind the scenes.
Right. You know, the Huffington Post reviewed Guilty Minds and said that in this book, Nick Heller did not come across as human as in your previous books that featured Heller. The reviewer suggested that maybe you relied too much on a reader's past knowledge of Heller, so someone coming new to your books might not engage with Heller as much. What do you think of that? Is that a valid point?
Nope, it's not about. I don't agree. That was actually written by someone who had read my other Nick Heller books. So I suppose that if someone picked up, let me put it to you this way. I write them so that anyone can pick up the book at any point in the series without having to read the first several ones. And in each book, I sort of bring out different aspects to Nick's personality and his background. But you don't need to know that from book to book. It's a series character, but one book does not depend on the one before that. So I don't actually agree, and I don't think most of my readers agree either.
So what are you reading now?
Well, I'm reading a number of things. I'm reading a book called A Little Life. I'm reading, which is a novel that came out, I think, last year.
Right.
I actually tend to read more literary novels when I'm writing, when I'm full-blast writing. I like to read books about families and dysfunctional families and relationships and marriages. I just think that fiction is really great as a way to explore our inner lives, and I sort of find that kind of a useful adjunct to read this while I'm writing my entertainment novels, so that I can keep in mind that the interiority is also important as the action.
What advice do you give to writers, especially those who may want to write a similar type of book?
Well, a number of things. One is I tell them to read copiously. I mean, read a lot in the genre they want to write in. I mean, that's the best way to learn. I tell them also that rejection is part of this business. It takes most people a long time to get an agent to get published. And you've got to be pretty stubborn about it. But what I've found is that people who really want to write, end up writing. Because it requires a kind of a stubbornness that, you know, to see it through rejections from agents or editors and that sort of thing. And the third thing I tell people is just write. Don't get too hung up on promotion and going on the internet and doing blogs and that sort of thing. Because the main thing you can do is to have another book for your readers to pick up.
I understand your next book will not feature Nick Heller. What are you working on next?
Yeah, it's another standalone. This is set partly in Boston and partly in Washington, D.C. It is also a conspiracy novel involving sort of an ordinary guy who gets caught up in something extraordinary. The thing is, I came up with this idea and I said to my editor, do you want me to do another Nick Heller novel or do you want me to do the standalone? And he said, you know what, do whatever you want. Maybe we can alternate. So I decided I'll write the standalone and the next book would be another Nick Heller, because the truth is I actually miss writing that character. I really love writing it.
All right. Well, Joseph Finder, who joined us from the studios of WCAI on Cape Cod, he's a Boston-based writer, and his latest book is Guilty Minds. You can read an excerpt at our website, radioboston.org. Joseph Finder, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker.
Poor soul, spit upon that poor soul. He never knew what hit him, and it hit him.
David Bowie fans should recognize this song. It's a cover of A Small Plot of Land from Bowie's 1995 album Outside, and this cover has special significance. It's by the Donnie McCaslin Group, the featured band on David Bowie's final album, Black Star. The group has a new album coming out in October called Beyond Now, and it's influenced by and dedicated to David Bowie. The Donnie McCaslin Group will be playing tonight at Boston's Museum of Fine Arts, and saxophonist Donnie McCaslin joins us in studio to talk more about the album. Welcome.
Good to be here.
Before we get to the interview, let's hear a little bit more of this song, A Small Plot of Land, with featured guest vocalist Jeff Taylor.
The thrill of your life, standing so near to innocent eyes, all dance. Swings through the tunnels and claws his way. He swears like so many.
Donnie McCaslin, why did you choose this song to cover?
I think, in a way, it just touched me when I heard it, and I could hear us doing an adaption that would be interesting. You know, he has such a huge discography, and there's so much to choose from. And, you know, as I was just scanning through things, my producer, David Binney, sent this one over with a few other tunes, and I remember hearing it and just feeling right away like, okay, yeah, this is something we can work with. And I could hear my voice on this tune and the band doing an interesting adaption. Mm.
So much emotion, which I have to wonder whether and how much a sense of mourning played into your selection of the songs because of what had happened to David Bowie.
Yeah, it's you know, tough for me to talk about, but especially...
I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. Mm-hmm. Especially Warsawa, because we were about to play a week-long engagement at Village Vanguard in January. I think this was the third week of January. And, you know, everything had just happened, and it was such a difficult time emotionally. And we were talking about wanting to pay tribute to David. What was the best way to do it? What would feel appropriate? And Jason Lindner, our keyboard player, suggested Warsawa, and we played it at the sound check, and then we ended up playing it every set of the week, every set of that week, and it just felt like it felt emotionally cathartic to have that song to funnel all these feelings through. Mm. So that was the beginning, and that was the one they said, well, you know, would love to record this, record our version of it. And then that led to A Small Plot of Land. And then the overall thing with the record, even as I started writing the music in the summer, a lot of the music from Black Star and David's music was kind of running in my mind. And he was just an exceptional person and artist. And making Black Star and working with him was a profound experience for me and the band. So I wanted to just pay tribute to him.
Right. Now, the title track of your album is also inspired by a song of Bowie's that you recorded, right? During
yes.
the Black Star sessions, but it didn't make it.
I mean, David, he wrote a lot of great songs for Black Star that didn't make the record. And this was one of them. I don't know what the title is, but it was one of the first songs he sent me, and just very strong. And it was actually the first tune that we recorded when we started working on Black Star. So again, I was just sitting at the piano, and that was running through my, a couple of the general themes of that song was running through my head, and I tried to let that be a foundation for my song.
Hmm. How did you meet David Bowie?
Well, it was through Maria Schneider, who I've played with for many years, and she was collaborating with David on a song called Sue, on a version of that with her big band, which I'm a part of. And when she was meeting with him, she suggested to him that he do something with me. And she played him a record of mine called Casting for Gravity. And that's sort of what started it, evidently. I think she suggested it again, and then she brought David down to hear us play at the 55 Bar, this little club in New York City. And it was about a week after that where I met him for the first time at the first rehearsal for Sue, which was just a stripped-down version of Maria's band. It was Mark Giuliana, actually, the drummer from my group, who had recommended to Maria for this, and Jay Anderson, Ryan Keverly, myself, David, Maria, and Tony Visconti, David's longtime producer. So that's where we met for the first time. We started talking, and he asked me for my email address, which seems funny to us, you know. But it was, you know.
Were you shocked?
I mean, I had an inkling because Maria had been telling me about their conversation. So I had an inkling that he was, that something might happen. But still, it seemed surreal to be meeting him and everything. But he was so wonderful and so present when we were together. And, you know, even though he was this icon and major star, you know, you just felt really at ease with him. Just a wonderful person.
Well, I want to make sure we get a little bit of music in. Let's play a little bit of the saxophone from David Bowie's Black Star. Let's listen. Very nice. Very nice. Donnie McCaslin, tell us about that collaboration process and how the saxophone solo. What were you thinking when this was happening?
Well, I think I was really trying to immerse myself in his music. And he had sent me demos before the Black Star sessions. And I just felt like I didn't really know what to expect in the studio. I worked with him on Maria's song, but Maria was conducting that session. It was with her big band. It was what I was used to. So I didn't know sort of how things would go. So I just tried to really know every song as deeply as I could, and then was trying to play from that place of knowing the song and trying to serve the music, I guess you would say. He was very passionate, and he sang with a lot of conviction. And I know that emotion was inspiring me to play. And that's, I think, kind of one of the things that I go to as a musician is I go for emotional expression. And so I felt, you know, in my group, a lot of what we do as improvisers is feed ideas off each other, and there's a lot of conversational stuff happening. And he stepped right into that. And we were doing it now within the framework of his songs, but he really participated in that. As we were throwing ideas to each other, he was also, you know, pushing us and stuff. So it was really fun. Mm. You know, it was really, really inspiring. So I guess I remember when we played that, I think that was the first take of that song, and I was just kind of thinking about the song. And not trying to come in with an agenda of like, well, I've practiced this and I can do this on the saxophone and I can play this. I tried to let go of all of that and just be in the moment, the way that I saw him being in the moment as an artist. And I just wanted to just play the music that was presented to me.
Was it difficult at all when you were working with him to sort of try to maintain your own voice? You know what I mean? Well, he could be easily overshadowed by a David Bowie, and it sounds like he didn't want that to happen, but how do you sort of make sure it doesn't?
Right? Yeah, I mean, I guess the thing was it was my band, and we have so much history together going into that that helped. It wasn't like I was just a hired gun coming in to play a couple solos. Mm-hmm. You know, it was this group, and we know each other. We played, we traveled together. So we have our language already coming into that. And I think that really helped. And then also David was really, couldn't have been more open to any suggestion I might have or anything I wanted to try. He set the environment at the very beginning of like, let's just go for this. Let's see what happens. Let's not worry about what, you know, style of music this is. Let's have a good time and let's do this. So I think it was a combination of those factors. I felt pretty at ease and felt like I could express myself. You know, on some of the songs I had orchestrated some of the horn parts with different woodwinds that I play and added little things, and he was totally open to it, and as was Tony. And I think as we went on day by day and seeing how happy they were with what we were doing, that was also a sense of affirmation of like, yeah, this is cool. They're into it. Like, great.
Right.
Just gonna go for it.
How do you think all of that's affected this new album?
Well, it's, let's see. I mean, it's, the relationships deepened in my band because of Black Star, just musically and because of everything that happened. So I think that's one thing that has really affected the new record, is just this deeper sense of connection within the band, deeper sense of interplay. I think in terms of the songs that I wrote, just on a deeper level in terms of giving the guys room to express themselves, better songs. And again, I just think because of everything that happened, this record, there's a sense of emotional catharsis about it when we were making it. And I wanted it to reflect the feelings of everything that had happened. So, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to do that.
I want to listen to a little bit more of Black Star. This is the track Lazarus. And I think there's really, it's a good example of some jazz influence here. Mm-hmm. Let's listen.
This way or no way, you know I'll be free. Just like that bluebird. Now ain't that just like me? Oh, I'll be free. Just like that bluebird.
That's the song Lazarus from David Bowie's final album, Black Star, featuring the Donny McCaslin Group. Donny McCaslin, when you hear these songs now, when you hear this album, do you have a greater appreciation? What does it feel like now that it's all together?
I feel like it was a really special experience that'll stay with me for the rest of my life. And hearing the record is I'm really proud of the way it sounds. I'm proud to be a part of it, and I marvel at his vision for putting these songs together, the way he wrote these songs. I'm grateful to him for entrusting us, you know, with being a part of it. It was just tremendous. I mean, I don't listen to the album a lot because of all the feelings involved, but when I do, I really enjoy it, and I think he sounds so great on it, and the lyrics are so profound.
Did you have any idea he was that ill?
You know, it's something that I don't talk about.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, what do you hope to do in terms of the future and collaborations in the future?
Well, I'm interested to see, you know, what might happen. I mean, I'm I'm very happy with how Beyond Now turned out. And in the immediate future, there's a lot of touring with that record. And Jeff Taylor, mm-hmm. who sang on A Small Plot of Land, is a great singer, and we're talking about a collaboration. And there might be some other possibilities. So I think I am looking towards, you know, some sort of collaboration with my group, with a vocalist or a group of vocalists, and just see what could happen that way in terms of songwriting. But really, I just am enjoying having the opportunity to play and develop music with my group.
All right. Saxophonist Donnie McCaslin of the Donnie McCaslin Group. The group's new album will be out this October. It's titled Beyond Now, and it's dedicated to David Bowie. The Donnie McCaslin Group will be playing at Boston's Museum of Fine Arts tonight as part of the museum's Concerts in the Courtyard series. They'll also be performing at Blue in Portland, Maine tomorrow. You can find more information about these events at our website, radioboston.org. And we're going to go out now on a track from the new album, Beyond Now. This is the title track. The Red Sox are tied for first place in the AL East, but manager John Farrell is still in the hot seat with some folks calling for his ouster. We're going to talk about that and much more with Bill Littlefield, who is host of NPR's Only a Game. Hi there, Bill.
Hey, Deb.
So what do you make of these calls to fire John Farrell?
That there are lots of people who don't have enough to do. Should be, you know, doing more important things with their lives.
Well, so
than trying to manage the Red Sox.
So, do you think that that he's still doing the job that he's been doing, or what do you think?
Well, you know, the interesting thing to consider is what the job of a manager is. They can't pitch, they can't field ground balls and throw them to first base, and they can't hit. All they can do is try to put the right nine guys on the field each night. And as far as that goes, John Farrell is doing better than a lot of other managers because, as you mentioned a moment ago, the Red Sox are at the top of their division, mm-hmm. at least at this point. The other thing to consider is that managers are hired to be fired. Managers who do wonderful things, like Terry Francona, who won the World Series a couple of times with the Red Sox, got fired. And now he's doing wonderful things in Cleveland.
Right.
So this is how it works. You can't fire the team. You fire the manager when they're not performing as well as you'd like.
Yeah. Now, John Henry, owner of the Red Sox, defended Farrell mm-hmm. in a Boston Herald interview over the weekend, saying that any of these calls for Farrell's ouster are, quote, mainly a radio and internet thing.
He said the same thing I did. John Henry and me were like this. You know?
So what do you think of those comments?
I'm a little concerned because it sounds suspiciously like the dreaded vote of confidence, which is often followed by the axe. I hope not.
Do you think that Farrell has a lot to prove then right now, not only to Henry, but to fans who say, you know, we want another trophy?
Of course they want another trophy. Everybody wants their team
but
to win.
But how many years do we wait, right?
Yeah, but they're in first place, as you pointed out. Right. I mean, what do you want them to be, 12 games ahead? You know, what do they have to be? And how long before Bill Belichick starts getting calls for, you know, Tom Brady's going to miss four games. Get him out of here. Get that coach out of there. Right?
Well, let's talk about football. Also, start of the season coming, even if the first quarter will be without Brady, because he's serving that four-game suspension over Deflategate. But, you know, some strange things happened in preseason, right? I mean, he missed the Thursday game against the Bears because he accidentally cut his thumb right before the game. And yesterday, Brady explained that he was trying to get something out of his shoe with scissors when the scissors slipped. We have a piece of tape from his explanation. Let's listen.
That's a crappy way to not be out there because it's a, you know, silly mistake. I'm glad it wasn't in the regular season. You know, I learned from it, and hopefully I won't be operating any more scissors. Oh, wow.
Now, Deb, you're not one of those people who believes that the conspiracy theory that the commissioner actually snuck into Brady's home and stabbed him in the thumb with a scissor, right?
I do not believe
good.
That.
I'm glad. We got that cleared up. That's
but,
good.
But it is a weird start to the season. He also missed practices Sunday and Monday, saying he had to, quote, take care of something. I mean, is it too much that we're following Brady's every move, or what's your take on all of this?
The former. I mean, if I were a pro football player, I would try to miss as much preseason as I possibly could, either by stabbing myself in the thumb with the scissors or by having something important to do somewhere else.
All right. So we don't know what Brady's going to do during this four games.
Well, we know that he's going to watch carefully and hope that his replacement doesn't throw 11 touchdown passes 4 weeks in a row, I guess.
Right.
No, seriously, he's going to serve out a suspension and hope that this goes away and that the Patriots play at least reasonably well over the first quarter of the season.
Yeah, but all of this still doesn't appear to have affected the Brady brand, if you will, all that much. Just this week, he launches a line of vegan snacks, right? Basically packages of fruits and nuts, sold 12 packages for $50, and the company sold out in 1 day.
Yeah. And what I'd like to know is how many people are eating these snacks and how many of them are putting them in small but tasteful frames over their desks to demonstrate that they have a Tom Brady endorsed snack.
But it is a brand.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, right? I know. Well, who was it that said you can't go broke underestimating the intelligence of the American people?
Right. Well, Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. You can hear Only a Game on WBUR Saturdays at 7 a.m. and again at 7 p.m. Thanks, Bill.
A great pleasure, Deb. Thank you.
And finally, a different kind of sport, celebrating this delicious time of year in New England when we can't seem to get enough of tomatoes.
Palate fatigue is a real thing.
That's Karen Schwabli. She's director of the Southeastern Massachusetts Agricultural Partnership, and she was a judge at today's 32nd annual Massachusetts Tomato Contest. 16 farms competed at the Boston Public Market to rate some of the finest tomatoes in the state. We sent Radio Boston's Catherine Dougherty to check the contest out, and she brought us this audio postcard.
My favorite tomato needs to have a balance of herbaceousness, of sweetness, and tanginess.
It has to be very firm inside and flavorful.
I like to have a good bite of acid in that first bite and then kind of a saltier finish. So I don't want a too sweet a tomato. I want a strong tomato flavor with some bite to it. My name is Karen Schwalbe, and I'm the executive director of the Southeastern Massachusetts Agricultural Partnership.
Hello, my name is Kevin Barry. I'm the director of produce at Big Y Foods out of Springfield, Mass., and I'm here today judging this tomato contest.
My name is Yasmin Healy. I'm a private chef, and I'm a tomato judge. I was just telling one of the other judges, do you feel like you're skinnier already? Because you feel so healthy by number 15, all these antioxidants.
Well, today they're going to have the opportunity to taste some of the greatest tomatoes grown in Massachusetts. We have over 750 farmers in Massachusetts who grow tomatoes commercially. They grow about 8.5 million pounds of tomatoes, yielding about $17 million worth of value. My name is John LeBeau. I'm the commissioner of the Massachusetts Department of Agricultural Resources, and we are one of the principal organizers of this event.
Everybody loves tomatoes. A tomato is just like a baby. You got to treat it with gentle care and love. My name is Peter MacArthur, MacArthur's Farm in Holliston. I won, first place 2004, first place 2008, and last year was 2015, first place.
My name is Kate Stillman, and I'm from Stillman's Farm in New Braintree, Massachusetts. And we are a vendor here at the public market, but we're also here today to participate in the annual state tomato contest. Every year, it's a different story. This year, we're kind of battling high heat and lower water, which actually makes for a fantastic tomato year. It's been tough on some of the other crops, but it concentrates the sugars and makes for a sweeter tasting tomato. So this is a fantastic tomato year.
We're going to pick tomatoes. Let the sun get high. When the sun gets low, no sense staring at the floor.
We heard from tomato judges Yasmin Healy, Kevin Berry, and Karen Schwalbe, along with the Massachusetts Agriculture Commissioner, John LeBeau. Also with them, farmers Peter MacArthur and Kate Stillman. They were speaking at the 32nd Annual Massachusetts Tomato Contest at the Boston Public Market today. And the results? Peter MacArthur won first place in the heirloom category. Stillman won fourth place in the cherry category. Other first place awards went to Ward's Berry Farm in Sharon, Langwater Farm in Northeastern, and Kimball Fruit Farm in Pepperell. Radio Boston's Catherine Dougherty produced our audio postcard along with our technical director, Tim Skog. That's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
I'll be your sweet water. I'll be your sweet water.